Motopod, proudly supported by Roadskin, a UK label specializing in protective outerwear for motorcyclists. Modern biker clothing that you can wear all day long and engineered to save your skin. For the road, for life, visit roadskin.co.uk. Welcome to Motopop, the internet radio show all about motorcycle road racing. This is episode number 762. I'm Jim McDowell. With me across the pond in the UK, as always, Richard Jowett. Good evening, Richard.
Evening, Jim. Good evening, everybody. We've got lots to talk about this evening. It's going to be a good show.
Yes, we do. There's some fantastic racing that's going on right there. But we get the housekeeping to do, Rich, and let's get that done here because it looks like there's some new subscribers that we need to talk about.
Well, yes, as I said to you a minute ago, Jim, although we were brought up to be told don't ask because you won't get, clearly if you do ask, you will get. So we're going to keep banging this drum because having made the call out to people last week or on the last show at least to say, look, we've got lots of people downloading the show, not so many people that are supporting the show from a financial standpoint. I have to say that we've had a fantastic response to that. So I'll just quickly go through the list, but suffice to say, if people can step up and sub to the show, I mean, there's good reasons to do so, which we'll talk about in a bit as well. So just going through in terms of our subscribers through PayPal, we've got Alan Fleming, Nick Saban, Nori Ito, new subscriber. Thanks, Nori. Rick Taylor, new subscriber. Thanks to you, Rick. Carl Huns, come on in the UK. Carl, brilliant to have you on board. And Jacob is also a new subscriber through PayPal. I think that's Jacob Nurkow. I hope I've pronounced that correctly, Jacob. And then in terms of our Patreon supporters, we've got Scott Baldwin that's come on board. So thanks to Scott. We've got, in terms of some people that were already with us, Ollie, Dennis Kindig, Jeremy Burnish, Jacob Rower, Darren Andrews, who's increased his support of the show, which is absolutely fantastic. Thank you, Darren. Paul Lang, Gary Shavit, and Steve. So that's an expanded roster of people that are chucking a few quid each month into the pot, Jim, and in some cases a bit more than that. So again, you know, we've got big plans for the show. There's lots we're putting in place, lots of organisations we're going through at the minute to give ourselves access to the BSB paddock, to the MotoGP paddock. We'll be doing a little bit of World Superbike stuff. We'll try and expand upon that as well. And Moto America, of course, is going to be exciting this year. So yeah, the more we get, the more we can do. And just to sort of further that thought, some people might have seen, and hopefully people are subscribing through the social media channels in terms of X stroke Twitter, and certainly the Instagram channel, which seems to be the one from a social media standpoint, Jim, that is, I think, has the most reach these days. I think that,
that's
sort of the go-to channel. So if you haven't subscribed to our Instagram channel, please pick it up and do so. But anyway, those that already have will have seen that we have got a very exciting association just launched with TAG Honda Racing in the British Superbike paddock. Now, TAG have been in the championship for many, many, many years. They've had a few lean years by their own admission, but they're now officially Honda supported and really looking to grow and move the team forward. So we will effectively become, you know, a partner of theirs, and they're going to give us a lot of exclusive access. So we'll be talking to engineers, team personnel, riders, of course, and we will be doing a deep dive as the BSB season goes on. Following them all year, I'll get to as many rounds as I possibly can, and we'll talk to people, give us the questions that you want answering about BSB and what's involved in running a team, sponsorship, all of it. You know, it's all up for discussion. I can talk to anybody in that team, supported by Charlie very kindly in the team, who looks after all this stuff. So yeah, we're going to be doing a lot of BSB stuff this year. And Carl, who I mentioned, who's come on, we're going to talk to him about perhaps stepping in and doing some of this BSB coverage along with myself, Jim, as well. So that'll increase things a bit further. Going back a little bit to the what I like to think of as the glory days of the show, almost, where there were four or five hosts that dropped in and out from various points, and people had their own, you know, specifics in terms of what they liked to talk about in terms of which championship it was. MotoGP will always be our primary focus, but the more we can do around World Supers, by the way, if anybody watched the race from Catalunya at the weekend, I mean, wow, that was just unbelievably good race, and then we must talk about that very briefly towards the end.
But didn't take long, did it?
Wow, I mean, just yeah, off the scale. So there's that. There's BSB and Moto America. So I know, Jim, you're going to be at a couple of rounds. Scott Bolton, again, been involved with the show for a long, long time. He's going to get to a few rounds as well. So lots of content coming. And the more we can get support from the subscribers and the listeners, the better it is for everybody. So yeah, that's the little kind of bucket rattling exercise done again.
Yep. So I'll remind you all, if you guys can't contribute to the show, we understand. We get that, but please go to where you get your podcast. Leave us a rating, leave us a review. That puts us back up at the top. Again, we're trying to be the best fan-based MotoGP podcast or motorcycle road racing podcast, basically, that exists. And that's the goal. We can't do it without you and the support that we get from you guys. So with that, that's enough housekeeping, Rich. We got to talk racing because, oof, wow, what a weekend. But I guess we technically should look at a quick bit of news. Let's just do this real quick. We learned over the weekend that Aldegar has a two-year deal to ride a Ducati in the Pramac colors for 25-26. I no surprise that Aldegar was going to MotoGP. There's a supreme talent there. Mouthwatering that is that the Acosta Aldegar championship battle could be here potentially. We'll have to wait a year to at least see them both on the track at the same time. So we'll talk about that. Now, we do have one piece of listener feedback. And this is from Scott Baldwin. So thank you, Scott, for writing into us. He's talking about the ride height devices and the hole shot devices that are on the motorcycles. And I'll try to summarize what he says here with it. But basically, he's saying, hey, you know, everybody used to roll up for a start, they'd slam on the brakes to compress the front end to set the hole shot device. But nobody does that this year. Everybody sort of rolls up. There's a bunch of button pushing and whatnot that's going on. And the bikes drop and literally almost are on the ground. I mean, if you... What they had a really good the Sunday start of Bastianini as he came up to the grid spot. There's a reason why we were focused on that. We'll get into that in the race coverage. But when Bastianini was done, that bike was the fairing of the bike had to have been no more than about 2 inches off of the ground at the start of all that. So the question is how is all this really happening now, and what's going on? So I think what they're doing, this is my guess, is that when Ducati came out with both the front and rear ride height that were both active, if you will, to where you could change the shape of the bike with the front and at the rear at the same time, I think that what they've done is they've taken that device or a similar functioning device and turned it into the hole shot device. So basically they're coming up, there's a set of buttons that are on the handlebar somewhere that they can then push to get it to go down. And it's going to do the same thing. It's basically hydraulic pressure that's basically pushing against something to push it down to that point of where it is. So, you know, it could be as simple as, you know, we're just that type of a system. And I think that's how they're doing it at that point. The rear ride height is as they would operate on the bike, but there, I believe that there's two different buttons. There's one for a start mode. Now, Scott does make mention that they were showing pictures of the handlebar, and maybe it was Ben Yaya's Ducati, but there's two buttons that are forward of where you can't see them, but the rider can look at it. I think those are the two buttons that control the ride height at the start of the race, because they're able to have that time to stop, look forward. You could see Bastianini look forward a lot when he was setting it up. I think Marquez does the same thing. I think they're looking forward to find the button. They're probably got some dimples in them as well to try to help the rider figure it out in his gloves, which one is which. One does the front, one does the rear. Now that rear setting is different than what would happen in the race. They're not going to drop the rear as far in the race as they would for the start. So hopefully that answers your question, Scott, or at least that's what I think they're doing and how I think that they're doing it. So really appreciate the feedback, Scott. I will endeavor to see what I can discover at COTA. Might be a little easier for me to see what's going on there at the track. And, depending on who I can talk to at COTA, inquiring minds may ask if I'm right or wrong about that. So we'll see. Okay. I think that's everything before we start talking racing, right, Rich?
Yeah.
Okay, so with that, let us get into the race weekend. We'll start, as always, with the Moto3 guys. We're looking at QP1. Now, I think we should preface this a little bit, Rich. There was a torrential downpour that happened on Thursday night that basically made the track positively, disgustingly dirty before free practice on Friday. In fact, you can still see the remnants of a lot of the dust from the dirt and whatnot that was on the track. It must have been a heck of a rainstorm to actually create that.
Basically everybody's first free practice was literally just a waste as they were, it was a track cleaning exercise. I think, didn't they red flag the first Moto 3 practice because it was pointless?
I must admit, I didn't see it, but it was shocking how much dust was on the track, actually. It was almost Qatarish, wasn't it, in terms of
yeah,
the
I thought we were
sand
in the desert
and
again.
Dust. Yeah. Yeah, it was weird. Yeah, but I suppose it's close to the coast, so it must pick
it
up
is.
A lot of stuff. But yeah, it was very, very dirty, green, as they like to say.
Yeah, so they did some track cleaning, and then people went out there. So much like in Qatar, the Moto2 guys got sort of the short end of the stick on the weekend for time and tires and stuff like that. Moto3 got it this weekend. So we'll maybe the next weekend in Qatar, well, everybody will get their fair share, and we'll see what happens there. But in that first session, Yamanaka, Furosato, and Perez, they all come through that session to get it there. So in the second session, Adrian Fernandez crashed out at turn eight, I believe. For a while, Kelso was on pole, followed by Alonso and Rueda. But Rueda had time left, so he had gotten across the start-finish line. And he was the only one of a group of people who made it in. Again, this is a classic Moto 3 thing that I hate. Everyone waiting in the pits to go out when there's like 1 minute left. Like, guys, how can you not backfigure the clock properly? Is no one taking a time of how long it takes you to get down the pit lane, and you add that to what it would take you for a lap plus some margin of error? But typical Moto 3. But because of that, getting across the line just in time to make one more lap, Rueda would go on to take a stunning pole lap to nip Kelso, who would start second. Alonso was on the front row. Then Holgado, Rossi, and Vire were all finishing out the first two rows. That's kind of what we always think, is that being those first two rows, Moto 3, maybe the first three rows. So on there, you had Vire, Ortola, Farrelly, and Ogden on that third row. So we're kind of seeing where it is. Munoz having a terrible weekend on there. He just did not qualify well at all. When the lights went out on Sunday, Ureta got the whole shot. Alonso was right there with him, Holgado. Kelso got off to a great start with Ortolo and Esteban there. So Yamanaka and Pickerez, the new kid on the block out at Leopard, they both went down at turn nine. It was basically Yamanaka crashed and Pecares had literally nowhere to go. And he was on the ground as well. Lunetta, he had a high side out of turn five. That was there. This race comes down to Rueda, Holgado, Ortola, Alonso, and Kelso. Those are the guys that are the main players as this race shapes up and goes down. Some things go through here, you know. Munoz has a great start. He kind of comes forward, but he then fades back out again. Kelso is always hanging towards the back of that line of people. And you had Alonso, who was at the front, went backwards, then went back to the front, then went backwards, and then went back again. Kind of like Alonso's motif, if you will, in the race. One of the things that's interesting about this, because of the lack of free practice on Friday, where a lot of teams tend to do their long run and look at the tire situation, tires were all over the place. So there was, some people had hard fronts and soft rears. Some people had soft, hard, hards. Some were soft, soft. People had all kinds of different combinations that really, you really couldn't follow. But it did make it interesting because we were trying to figure out like who had what as the racing goes on. Vire made a dash up through the pack. He was coming to it as well. He had got himself up to like seventh or whatever. But what was really interesting was Rueda was absolutely untouchable in that fourth sector. As Rueda would lead, he would pull like two, maybe three bike lengths in that fourth sector. His speed, it was his drive out of 13 and the corner speed he carried through 14, 15 that put him ahead of everyone as they would go down the front straightaway. Now, the draft pulled everybody back together again, as you would expect in Moto 3. But it was interesting that he just had that much speed on everyone at that point in the game. Alonso had a small miscue at turn three. He had to sit it up. He was late on the brakes. He tried to avoid Holgado and get out of that situation. But at one point, somewhere around eight laps left to go in the race, Alonso got to the front and it looked like he was going to try to get away. He had a soft tire on the rear. So it was odd to see Alonso look like he was trying to break away from people, but maybe he sensed something that we didn't know about, or maybe he felt like the tire was going to last, but it was like, wow, that's a different idea of how to win a race from Alonso when we expect him to sort of be riding around in that 4, 5, 6 position. The interesting fact is the person who's riding around in that 4, 5, 6 position on a harder rear tire was Kelso. Kelso did not want any piece of the drama that was in front. He simply, and if Vire caught him and was right there and passed him, Kelso would fight right back to maintain that sort of sixth place. So at one point, they got really kind of separated and the racing was just sort of processional, but it all got pulled right back together again when we got down to like 4 laps to go. At this point, Kelso had charged up from the sixth to a fourth. Helgardo had gotten to the front ahead of Alonso, and Rueda was back to third. Then Kelso got squeezed back to sixth. You know, as the racing gets a little bit more frantic and elbows come out, the odd man out in the situation, and this was on the main stretch, was the fact that it was a double draft, and I think it was Rueda and Vire who were trying to split around Kelso, and they got real close together, and I think Joel kind of had discretion as the better part of valor here and just closes the throttle just that little bit that allows them to go back, and he now is back in like that sixth place again. But what happens then is we get into that last lap where Helgardo, who has been leading, rides essentially the lap of his life because he needed to have a little bit of a gap going into that final sector because Rueda was right there the whole time. But it became a two-horse race between Helgardo and Rueda. Helgardo would hold on and basically steal a race from Rueda, in my opinion. I don't know how you saw that one, Rich. But Ortola would be third. Alonso is fourth. Kelso takes a fifth with Vire sixth. A great Moto3 race. I don't think we're really going to see a bad one. Tires threw this off a little bit as to where everybody was, but essentially, you know, it was those main players that were there. For me, Helgardo had a great ride. Would you agree, Rich?
He did. I mean, we mustn't forget that they're still figuring out the Pirelli tires in this class. Yes. Although, you've alluded to the fact that people were on different tires. Although I think amongst that kind of front pack of 5 or 6, as the race went on, it was only Kelso that was on the medium.
Kelso was
rear.
The odd man out on that.
Yeah, so he was the odd man out. So whether that was a tire choice that didn't quite work, it was hard to really know because it looked like he was biding his time, didn't it? But then for one reason or another, he never really kind of was able to make that tire work. Whether it was an advantage or a disadvantage, obviously we don't quite know. One would assume it was a slight disadvantage because he didn't win the race. But I mean, Helgardo, again, we've talked about this a lot. Well, certainly through the back end of last year, and as we kind of approach the beginning of this season, he did have this kind of start last year. So the question in my mind is, can he maintain this through the year? Because he really is a very strong rider. And I think probably I wouldn't quite go along quite as far as to say that he pinched it from Rueda, because I mean, Helgardo did lead a lot of laps.
Yeah, that's true.
And he did look very, very good.
I guess I kind of thought he kind of pinched it from him just because of the fact that Rueda was so strong through 13, 14, 15 that Helgardo had to ride a really good lap and get through that last section. Cause I think Rueda would have gotten him if Helgardo hadn't rode 13 as defensively as he did. So by all means, it was good work by him to do that.
Yeah. I mean, they had relative strength and weaknesses at different parts of the track, didn't they? Rueda, cause let's just sort of backtrack a little bit. Helgardo was very strong in the first half of last year, as we said, and had various bad luck and problems and tailed off, which cost him, you know, a chance to fight for the championship. But he will have gained an awful lot of experience from last year. Rueda, by contrast, came in as kind of the next Pedro Acosta. That was kind of the fanfare that he came in with and had a pretty quiet year. I think he broke his leg or got badly injured at some stage in the season.
Yeah, there was some injury that he definitely
I'm pretty sure that happened.
I think it was his leg.
He kind of went under the radar a bit last year and didn't really capture my attention too much through last year. But clearly, again, with that first season under his belt in the full Grand Prix Championship, you know, he's come out all guns blazing this year. But I think possibly Helgardo is just that little bit more mature, a little bit more experienced, slightly better racecraft, perhaps. So my thought was perhaps was Rueda overdoing it in the first sort of two-thirds of the race in terms of, as you say, he was so quick through that final sector, which does take a lot out of the tyre. Whereas Helgardo, I think, is a bit more canny. So I think he was planning his ambush. You know, the thing that we weren't quite sure about was Alonso going to do a kind of last two lap kind of thing that he normally does, and whether he burned his tire out because he just didn't feature in the end, did he? So
no,
it was an intriguing race. It wasn't the most exciting of races, but it was certainly, it helps us to see, I think, how this season is going to go. And it's a little bit odd that Vaya wasn't a little bit stronger in the race, perhaps. He didn't have a particularly brilliant Qatar, but again, we're only two races in. So, I mean,
I'm wondering if Vaya doesn't quite understand the Pirelli yet.
Yeah, and he's one of the bigger riders as well.
So he should be able to put energy into that tire, right? I mean, bigger, he should be able to put the energy into the tire. But is that what the Pirelli needs? Does it need energy to work, or is it the lighter touch that these other guys have? It just seems like, to me, that's one of the things I want to talk about, was where's Vire and all this? He's six. He didn't really have a good Qatar. I think based on what happened at the end of last year, I think we thought we'd see him on the podium by now.
Yeah.
And he's not. It doesn't mean that he won't figure it out, but you're kind of spotting the guys a little bit too much here. I get it. We've got 18 or 19 rounds, depending on whether you believe Kazakhstan's actually going to happen or not.
Yeah.
So you don't, I don't think anybody wants to spot anybody. And then again, you've got Munoz, who finished ninth, which was weird as well. Like, Munoz doesn't seem to have it figured out either. Maybe, I'm not sure. It's this is one of the things that I'm really curious about, is the Pirelli. What does it feel like compared to the Dunlap? Where is its strength? Where's its weakness? I don't know where that is, but this little bit of tire intrigue that's been going on in both Moto 2 and Moto 3 is really fascinating. I like the idea that people are picking different tires and different combinations. I think it was so bland for a certain time there with Dunlap. I am not knocking Dunlap people. Dunlap is a great tire. Pirelli is a great motorcycle tire. It's just the fact that it was like, well, okay, everybody's going to go with a soft front and a medium rear. Everyone's with a medium front and a hard rear, or everybody's on a soft. It was like the whole pack was always on the same set of tires. There wasn't anything different. There's no bit of the chess match that you want to see happen between riders. But we do kind of see that now. Again, is this just purely because of the weekends that we've had? The rain in Qatar that left the Moto 2 guys without as much practice. Is this one because it was so dirty for FP1, for Moto 3, that all of this just is part of the chaos that I love to root for? But it's a storyline that I want to see, and see how it develops as we continue on down the season.
And let's not forget, we've lost, by which I mean they've gone up. So Dennis Onchu's gone, Jarman Massey has gone, Sasaki has gone. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the complexion of the championship is different, with a number of very experienced key riders that would always be up the front. They're not there at the minute. So, the competitive order is reshaping itself, and it'll take a few rounds for that. Plus, obviously, the jeopardy and the opportunity that the new tyre supplier brings into all of this as well. One person that was noted, or has been notable in the first two rounds by their kind of lack of progress, is Tatsuki Suzuki, for example.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's surprising that he hasn't gotten there.
Yeah, I mean, he's jumped onto Sasaki's bike, you know, the bike that was runner-up last season. So there's a few people underperforming, and you've mentioned Munoz a couple of times, so he would be another one. But we're only two rounds in, and there's been a lot of changes, a lot of different riders and different teams and so on and so forth. So it takes a bit of time for all this to start to settle out. But there's no doubt in my mind that Holgado, Rueda and Alonso are going to be, in all likelihood, the three guys that, you know, are sharing most of the wins this season.
I think those three names are going to be on the podium more than anybody else. I'll give you that one.
Yeah.
Interesting note here as well. First Honda, 10th. After the really kind of stunning Qatar round, to a tighter, twistier circuit, the Hondas weren't there. So interesting, I think.
We kind of talk or face this every year. We have done for several years. Yeah, because the Honda's always a couple of steps behind the KTM. And I know there are other brands out there, but they're all basically KTMs, aren't they?
They're all KTM clones. Come on. They are what they are.
Poor old Honda, I mean, not something you would normally say, but their relative woes in Moto3, because they're not that far behind, but as you say, 10th first Honda home is not great. Obviously, MotoGP will come to, and World Superbike is borderline disaster as well at the minute. So the Honda are not having a happy time at the moment.
No, and the KTM is completely different this year. It's charge the corner, slam on the brakes, and flick it in, drive it back out. It's not the corner speed beast that it was.
Yeah, I don't understand the complexities of it, Jim. You probably do. You almost certainly will more than I do. But the KTM is quite different this year, I believe.
Very takes a very different style of riding this year to make the KTM work. You have to just charge the corner, slam the brakes on, and then bend it into the corner. You can't trail brake it to the apex and carry corner speed in. It just doesn't work that way.
Now, do you suppose that KTM have done that because of the tire change that they knew was coming, or is it just that Honda have not kind of thought about this enough? Honda always seem to get caught a little bit behind the game in recent years, don't they? I mean, they used to be the guys that set the tone, but those days seem to be somewhat behind us now, or behind them, was the point.
Well, I mean, let's be honest. Find me any Honda throughout history that ever really handled. I mean,
you've said it before.
Some are better than others. I'll give you the RC30. That one, right? That was a very well balanced motorcycle, and it was very good. It was obviously good enough to win a couple of World Superbike titles. So that's sort of the outlier. But the RC45 was a beast. It didn't want to turn. You had to make it turn. RC51, kind of the same thing. It labored to turn. You can go through the history with that, right? Where was I going with all this? Oh, the Hondas just don't really handle well. They've always got power, always have got a motor, right? They're probably not in MotoGP. They're probably the third best motor now, as far as like top end speed, horsepower. I'll put the KTM and I'll put the Ducati ahead of them. But I just don't think Honda's going to improve their Moto 3 bike when their MotoGP team is suffering the way that they are. I think the priority is going to be to make the MotoGP bikes better. And, you know, I agree that Honda has been on the back foot in all classes here of late, but I would not bet against them in the new rules in 27 with the 850cc motors and, you know, the idea of you can change around bore and stroke to do something different. I wouldn't put it behind Honda not to have a decent motor that comes out of that one, whether it's in a decent chassis. It's a whole nother world depending on what we do with aerodynamics or whatever it is that we're going to do. So with that, I think we'll cover unless you have something else about the Moto 3 race to say, Richard.
Well, not about the race. No, the only thing I'm going to correct myself for, I can, you know, imagine people screaming at their speakers as they're listening to this. I mean, it must be said that Massi was riding a Honda and won the Moto 3 championship last year. So it's not disastrous for Honda, but the KTM has moved ahead again this year, as tends to be the case. And Honda have some catching up to do in Moto 3. I think that's probably the point. It's not that disastrous, you know, as a constructor, they're, let's say, the reigning champion. Correct. Although people can take their issues with how the championship was won last year, we won't retread that.
Ooh.
But anyway, but clearly the Hondas have a bit of work to do to get up front. And Leopard, for various reasons, new riders, you know, they're not the power force that they were last season, are they? Or not at the moment, at least.
Okay. So after two rounds, Helgardo leads the championship on 45 points, followed by Alonso on 38, difference of 7. Ortola is 20 out on 23, then Vire, Rueda, Kelso, Nepa, Ferrosato, Rossi, and Esteban. That's your top 10 for Moto 3. And with that, I think we'll move to the Moto 2 qualifying event. So with Moto 2 qualifying, I think there was no Dixon again. Jake did try. Sorry, Rich. I know that hurts. It hurts me too. I miss Jake on the grid. I really do. He tried to ride. It was determined that himself and the team discussed it, and he decided to withdraw. That was a heart-wrenching decision that Jake made. I understand why he made it. I applaud him for understanding there's not a reason to ride a motorcycle until you are better. You get 3 weeks, essentially, now to heal even more before we get to COTA. So I truly understand where he was there. But we had, the QP1, Chantra, Chantra, Agura, Morera, and Senna Aegis all got out of that first qualifying session. And the second qualifying session, Vietti had a huge moment with it where he almost just threw it all away but got it back, which was pretty crazy. Gonzalez would sneak in to get a pole. He had a lap coming from absolutely nowhere, and it was a great lap where he pipped Canet and or sorry, where he pipped, sorry, where he pipped Canet and Audiger because it was Gonzalez who would take the pole. Audiger would be second because he ran Canet back to third, i.e. Audiger. Or no, Canet simply didn't have the speed to get past in there, if I remember correctly. Got my notes are a little backwards there. But then it was Alonso, and then Joe Roberts had really not set a time at all that looked competitive, but he jumped up on his last lap to be fifth. Following up on what was a pretty good qualifying and race in Qatar, seemed like momentum was still with Joe, which was good to see from this part of it. Arenas was there, then Ayagura and Garcia and Chantra. That's like the first three rows for the race. So that's how that part of it worked. So we go into the Moto2 race. Now, this one is not a tire issue because everybody was on the SC0 tire, which is the softest one that Pirelli brings, which I think that's almost exactly the equivalent of their World Superbike tire. Yeah.
That's what they were kind of suggest. I don't know. I mean, I have no
idea. Yeah. I'm sure there's some difference to construction or whatever between them, but their compound range is essentially an SC0. And that's like, I think World Superbike or qualifies on those or something like that. But a side note for Pirelli, Pirelli is the sole tire supplier to Formula One. They're the sole tire supplier to Moto2, to Moto3. I would not bet against Pirelli being the sole tire supplier. They are the sole tire supplier to World Superbike. Sorry. British Superbikes are all on Pirelli.
Yeah.
It seems to me like Pirelli wants to be the number one dominant tire in the motorcycle arena. Like, I do not put it past Pirelli to be on MotoGP bikes here shortly.
You would imagine that they're going to tender as soon as the opportunity arises. It would make a lot of sense, yeah. But whether you stray into issues around monopoly kind of territory, I don't know, because as you say, they're pretty much the tire supplier everywhere. I mean, obviously not in Moto America. That's American Dunlop, isn't it? Is that right in the Superbike class?
Yeah. It's Dunlop. It is Dunlop, yeah. Which that's simple, quick side note, I promise people. Say what you want about Moto America. There's a lot of people who there's as many people in the camp of that they need to go to a Pirelli tire in Superbike and Super Sport just as much as there's as many people say no, stay on the tires that you're on. I mean, I can't help but sit there and go, if you want to go overseas, wouldn't you want to be on a Pirelli? Well, anyway, never mind.
Well, these decisions are always contractual and money based in terms of who gets
sponsoring and all that good stuff, right?
Yeah.
And again, I'm Hunter. I know that the Dunlops are made in America here. Whether Pirelli has a place to make tires here in the U.S., I don't think that they do. I think all their stuff is based in Italy, as far as I know. But that remains to be seen. I don't know what Pirelli will do. But anyway, enough about Pirelli because this Moto2 race is pretty good race. At the very beginning, if you noticed, Audiger stuttered off the line and then got going. And I was like, my first thought was, did he jump? Because I couldn't tell if he like went with the light and then clutched it because he had a little too much or was trying to slip the clutch and it was too much or it was wheeling and he went for the clutch, something to that effect. Wasn't too sure what was going to happen there, but he was at the front with Lopez and Agüero and Gonzalez there, Kennett, and then Roberts. As soon as they kind of got themselves settled up there a little bit, Lopez just barged by Audiger at turn 13. It was it was Boscacura on Boscacura crime, basically, because it was brutal. Completely fair, and I loved it. That's just the definition of hard racing. That was basically where that happened. Then the bombshell drops. Audiger has a jump start. Now, they slowed it down. They showed several angles of it. I'm not going to disagree. They've got sensors and all this stuff to figure out if you know the rule. You cannot move before the light. But holy crap, I'll tell you, Rich, Audiger did not miss that by much. I mean, it was razor thin of him moving before the light. And I was like, man,
close call.
I get the call. I understand the call. But the penalty for the call is two long laps of inconvenience. And at Portimao, that's a long, long lap penalty.
Yeah.
So it goes around the outside of 13. It's at the end of the lap around 13. It's like, ooh, okay, wow. We're going to have to watch what happens here with all that. So now it's a watch of what happens to Audiger because it's Lopez, Kennett, and Agüero are there at the front, Roberts in fifth, and Arbolino has snuck in there to like seventh, which expected more out of Tony. There was bad qualifying by Tony, right? And then I thought, okay, well, at least in the race, he's going to race to the front. That kind of how he does it. But, you know, we'll see how that turns out here. But Audiger goes through the first of the two long laps. He went in second. He came out in 13th. That put him 5.3 seconds behind. Now, you have 5.3. So you have five laps in which to take both of those long laps. He waited a couple of laps because there was a gap that was opening up. Now, they never show us the pit boards. I wish we could see the pit boards and stuff. I believe that the team was telling him, hey, look, there's a gap between you where you're running in 13th and the people that are 14, 15. If you run two more laps, which you're allowed to do before you take that next long lap penalty, then he was able to put his head down, get that little bit of a gap, and then go right back in to the long lap penalty, get that done, and get it back again. Well, you're kind of attention focused there about what's happening. Lopez just crashes out of turn 13 with a half a second lead. Lopez was getting away. I don't think there's anybody who would deny that Lopez was inching himself away, but apparently he just went too far, too much, and lost the front end. Was he a little deep? Was he a little offline? Was he a little bit in the dirt that maybe should or should not have been there due to the rain? Don't know, but it sure looked like he was just a little too much out there with a little too much front brake and the front end buckles and underneath it goes.
I mean, it's a tricky one, Jim, isn't it? Because you shouldn't really be crashing out of the lead that early in the race. But who are we, and certainly who am I to criticize? I mean, he was trying to get halfway. Yeah, okay. For some odd reason, I'm a big fan of Lopez because some of his behavior on track has been quite questionable in the last couple of seasons. I think that's putting it reasonably mildly. But there's something about the way he goes about things. I mean, that pass he put on Aldegar was a proper no-holds-barred move, wasn't it? You know, he's got a bit of a point to prove, you know, because Aldegar's got that Pramac Ducati Works contract in his back pocket. And Lopez has been pretty good. I mean, Aldegar, okay, you know, he's the man of the moment because he went on that rip at the end of last season and so on, whereas Lopez was better in the first half of the last year. So he perhaps feels a bit disgruntled and has a bit of a point to prove. So whether that was a bit of a contribution to the fact that he just pushed that wee bit too hard. And again, have to caveat everything with, you know, these guys are still learning these tyres. They haven't had a lot of track time on these bikes, particularly, as you said, Jim, both at Qatar and here with rain and bad track conditions and stuff, that's really eaten into people's time to learn. So you just have to kind of give him a bit of a pass on that one, I think. But it was a real shame because he was doing well. However, other good things would transpire as the race went on. So Lopez will come back strong, no doubt. And I definitely think he's going to be a title contender all season long this year, for sure.
Agreed. While we were figuring out what was happening to Lopez in the crash, Roberts got by Agüero and was in a podium position. Jim casually looked and checked the desk drawer to see if the flag was still there. And it was, and then promptly closed the drawer.
Keep it under lock and key, anyway. Jim.
Yes. Lock it under lock and key, you know. So as it goes on, Kennett's now leading. Roberts has gotten to second ahead of Gonzalez and Agüero. Aldegar is eighth, and he's 3.3 seconds down, and the man is turning fast lap after fast lap after fast lap. He is the fastest man on track, and the question became, I think he can win this. I really, really thought Aldegar could win this race because there was just enough time if he could keep, because he was taking like 4 5/10 out a lap.
Yeah.
It wasn't like, oh, he's taking a 10th here and then maybe 2/10. He was chunks. Understand, it is a spec motor and a spec chassis class, basically. Okay, I know there's four Bosca cores out there, please. I get it. But still, he's flying on this thing. And that's the point. The point is he's flying. But the other question was, is he going to just torch the rubber? Because we sort of had that happen in Qatar. If you had the medium, that was the wrong tire to be on. The soft was the right tire to be on. Well, everybody's on the soft, but the temperatures are different. The track surface is different. There's a whole bunch of other variables in here. And if he's really pushing it that hard, is he going to have any rubber left when we get to the end? Well, no one really knows, and we're not going to know until we actually get there. So Aldegar and Arenas are battling with each other for fifth. Kennett's got 6/10 on Roberts. Roberts has got 3/10 on Gonzalez. And then there's another further 8/10 between Gonzalez to Agüero. So Gonzalez would get by Roberts at turn one. And I was proud because Joe fought back to get back in front of Gonzalez again. And he did it quickly. It was a couple turns later, fought back, got back in front. I was glad to see Joe have that fight in him. And he just was like, oh, I'm going to settle for the podium kind of a thing. No, he was fighting for where he thinks he should be, which is at the front of the Moto2 pack. And I agree with that as well. Kennett was starting to slide away from people at this point. You know, he was up to 7/10. I think he was going to break away. You know, basically after that, everybody from 2 to 5 was all together, grouped together. Two positions, 2 from 5 had gotten together. So Kennett is basically sliding away on this. And everyone's thinking it like, is this going to be Kennett's first win? He's had many of these taken to him, mainly him crashing himself out of a lead that he now had. But we saw Lopez do it. So you're going, well, you know, you giveth and you taketh away. You know, maybe luck is going to fall to the proper side for Aaron if all that was going to do there. But at the end, it was truly Kennett. He did win the race. Roberts would finish second. Very proud to see Roberts on the podium there, especially a little bit of momentum. Really good race in Qatar. He loves Qatar. He's done well here at Portimao. He's got his victory is here. albeit in some really strange circumstances. Let's be honest about that one and up front. But that was a really good ride by Joe to be on the podium, to be there second. Gonzalez hangs on for third. Audiger could do no better than get to fourth. He's followed by then all the Bosque Corras because Audiger, Agura, and Garcia, they're all there to get to sixth with Vietti seventh. So that is how the race ended. Again, fantastic for Kennett to finally get that victory that has been long eluding him. The emotion and pour out was just great to see from him, the team, everybody else was super excited for Aaron to get that. Roberts with a great ride. He's got a shot at this if he can keep it going. I can't wait for Coda. I want to see how Joe goes at home. And then, and wherever is going to happen with Audiger. So this is a really good Moto2 race. It had sort of the crazy twist. It had the long lap penalty for Audiger. It had the crazy, which was Lopez falling off in front of Canet and Canet winning.
Yeah, it was in fact, I'd go so far as to say the Moto2 race was more enjoyable than the Moto3 race, which was not something that you get to say all that often. But again, that might be true. Something we say more now that we've got the tire thing.
Yeah.
Messing things up. You were saying about Audiger's charge. The thought occurred to me, if it's true that the tyres they run in the Moto2 class are quite similar to the World Superbikes, then there is a lot of precedent for the tyre drop in World Superbike. You know, when the Pirelli goes, it really goes. And we saw this with Nico Bulliger in the first World Superbike race on Saturday. He was way out front, had like a 5-second lead with 5 or 6 laps to go. And then Top Rack, his tyre just went off a cliff and he had no grip at all. My suspicion was with Audiger that charge was going to cost him at the end, potentially. I mean, you don't know because it's a different class.
Yeah, and the front was trashed. I mean, you could see the blister and the edge on the right side of that Pirelli front. It was trashed.
Yeah. I mean, different bike to a lot of the others. You know, setup is important. Every rider is different in terms of their weight and how they position themselves, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So no two bikes are the same. It's true. But I think it's generally understood that, if you take a lot out of them, you're going to pay the price towards the end. Whereas Kennett could keep a fairly steady pace, a fast pace, but wasn't having to overwork the tyres, let's say, out front. Whereas Audiger put that charge in and it was a great charge because, as you say, at times he was 0.5 seconds a lap quicker than the guys up front. But you kind of did have that feeling that he was going to hit a bit of a brick wall. So overall, finishing fourth for him was a pretty good result, given that jumpstart double long lap penalty. A question for you, Jim, because I remember this happened with, and it sticks in my mind because it was Cal Crutchlow, where he, again, an infinitesimal little move. I forget which race it was, and obviously it's a few years ago now because Cal's been out of the main championship for a while. But it's often occurred to me that obviously you have the line that your front wheel can't go beyond when you start the race. Why can't they have an intermediate line 2 or 3 inches beforehand, which gives you a little creep zone? You still can't go over the extremity line of your grid slot because otherwise you're starting to take an unfair advantage. But I don't see why they can't stop a little bit further back if they want and have a little buffer zone where if they move just a tiny little bit, they're within that range where it's okay, provided they don't go over the main white line of their slot. I mean, thoughts?
I don't have a definitive answer to why it's that way. I understand why they do it. Is one, if you have everybody on the front row and nobody can move, right? It's the fairest start you can possibly have. It's also the easiest way to judge a start as comparison to when the light goes, to when the clutch goes, and to when the bike moves. If you allow that creep in there somewhere, everybody's going to want that creep. And then it's going to become, well, he had his wheel 3 millimeters closer to the back white line than I did. Well, he's got 3 more millimeters of creep than I got, and that's not fair. And you wind up with all kinds of craziness that happens in there. I mean, dirt track, that's what we did. You'd roll up to that line. They would pull your tire to that line. First thing you did was want to roll that back. As soon as they could turn their back and they were off, they couldn't touch you. Everybody's going backwards because everybody wants to have that creep in the dirt, right? That's the first thing you do. It makes it really difficult to judge that. And I've been on both sides of it. Especially if you have like we would have sometimes a staggered start restart in dirt track. So the first guy, then to my left was the guy running second, third, whatever, da 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 da, as you go back, and then they'd work the other way. It's the problem then is that the only thing anybody's watching is the front guys. Great. That's the other problem. Because if you let that go, there's only so many eyes that are looking at the grid. And there isn't one person for every bike looking at whether or not they're going or not, right? There just isn't.
Well, they obviously have pressure sensors on the line on the grid now, don't they? So
that's what I'm saying. That's why they got all these sensors and stuff.
I mean, bloody hell, if you look back at a race from the 1970s, I mean, some people are 3 feet up the road before the light or the, or the flag drops. I mean, it was an absolute joke back in the day.
Yeah.
Whereas now we've got technology, the sensors, so they can detect it. But my point is, if you've got a grid box, let's say it's a you've got a foot that you can stop in. So your front tire's on the ground, there's a sensor in the ground which can detect movement. If you're 3 inches back from the absolute extremity of where you're allowed to start in terms of that grid slot, and you creep an inch, you might get a penalty for that, whereas you haven't really taken any advantage. That's my point. I mean, maybe I'm wrong. I don't know. This is something perhaps...
But if nobody else is rolling and you are, then you have an advantage.
Not if you're beyond your grid, a lot of your grid slot, you're not, because you can start several inches further anyway, provided you don't move.
I believe that if you have any bit of momentum, it is better momentum than anybody else, right? So if you're cunning enough to be able to, you know, again, the pressure sensor is there, but what triggers it?
Yeah.
So if I'm smart enough to be able to adjust my bike so that when I let go of the clutch and I start that roll, I can get the bike to wheelie a little bit or transfer weight off the front. Am I going to trip the pressure sensor or not? How many guys are going to try to go after that one, right? We have enough problems with tire pressure sensors, let alone wheel sensors to figure out whether you're moving or not. That let's just not even go with
no,
that.
I know. We mustn't introduce more controversy.
We can't do any of that.
From a spectating point of view, you know, having somebody get a long lap.
I don't think that matters. I guess I cut you off. I shouldn't have done it. Please explain your point, because I think what I was going to answer is not what you were going to ask. So,
well, no, all I was going to say was that, you know, when these things happen and a rider gets a long lap or a double long lap, from a spectator's point of view, it introduces interest because they've then got to fight their way through, as indeed Aldegar did. But from the rider's point of view, it must be a real kick in the what's-its when you've toiled away to get that position. And then, you know, your front moves, a few millimetres, centimetres over. And you get that level of penalty. Just seems a bit tough to me. And I just wonder if there is a better way. But at the same time, yes, I do take your point. Let's not introduce yet more controversy. There's enough of it already normally.
I thought you were going to say like, oh, spectators don't care about what happens there at all at the start of the race. And I'm going like, no way. No way. Everybody can understand a jump starter or non-jump.
Oh, yeah. No. I think everybody understands and is invested in every aspect of the race. Certainly the people that listen to this show. Watch the races like we do. We're over every little detail. That's why we're talking about it more now than we ought to be.
Ad nauseum, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So with that, let's look at the Moto2 World Championship. Kinnett is now leading the World Championship on 31 points. Roberts is in second place on 29 points. Then we have Gonzalez, Garcia, Lopez, Agüero, Baltas, Ramirez, Vietti, and Arenas. So
I'll say one last thing, Jim.
Sure, go ahead.
Love Joe Roberts' new crash helmet design.
Yes, it's brilliant. I love it too. Yeah. I like it. I like
sweet.
It a lot too.
Really sweet.
It seems like he's really gelled again with American Racing Team, because I didn't quite understand whether he was still getting coaching or advice from Hopkins or not, because Hopkins stayed with American Racing when Joe went over to Taltrans. But I don't remember if he was going back and forth a little bit in that, or if there was really as much time that they could spend together. Because I think, really, technically, Hopkins is American Racing's rider coach for those riders. And I'm wondering if it's just having him back again that just kind of maybe puts Joe at ease a little bit. You know, as far as I remember, Hopkins is a Californian too.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's one Californian to another laid-back California. I mean, he's laid-back California anyway, but, you know, but that's a stereotype, right?
Roberts, that is, certainly seems much more comfortable back there, doesn't he? I don't know what caused him to leave, whether he just fancied passes new, thought it might kick on his career, which it didn't. So he's kind of gone back. But I don't see it as a backward step to go back there.
No.
A sideways move, perhaps. Although, actually saying that, based on the results from the first two rounds, he's actually taken a step forward, hasn't he? So, yeah. And Ramirez doing pretty well as well. I know it was controversial the way that all spun out at the end of last year with, you know, other riders that were in that team setup getting kind of binned off late in the day, which wasn't great. But anyway, putting that to one side, American Racing having a pretty solid start to the year, which is good for all the American fans and elsewhere as well.
Great. Great for the American fans. With that, we will go on to MotoGP and go to the first qualifying. Acosta's in that first group. You know,
only just.
Only just. only just. But then, you know, I think everybody else is there who you would expect to be there of the leftovers. Acosta is the outlier of it all. But Alex Marquez pipped Acosta by 0.005 of a second to be the fastest man in that Q1 session. But what really counts is your Q2 session. Well, Rins and Quartararo actually made it directly to the Q2, the two. Wow, let's try that again. Made it directly into Q2.
There you go.
Well, those two made it directly into Q2. Jim has it right now, which was great to see. Marquez was down at turn 15. He had tucked the front and took a very long slide along the pavement there. Again, you see Marquez, I think, struggling to understand the Ducati, because I think in that moment of front-end griplessness that he went to the diverged idea of how he raced a Honda, because that's what he knows, and that's not what the Ducati won.
Well, at some point on the Sunday, it transpired, or I heard, that he had actually activated the rear ride height device a wee bit too early, and it unloaded the front, which is why he crashed.
Oh, that was what caused the crash in qualifying?
That's what they said. Yeah, so he just pressed the button a wee bit too quick.
That's a bit ballsy way back there at 14 down the hill, and you're going to drop the back end?
Yeah.
That's ballsy. But then again, Marquez has got balls. I ain't going to...
So, because it was noticeable, let's not get ahead of ourselves, or not get ahead of myself, but he crashed quite a lot this weekend, didn't he, Jim?
Yeah, that's where the old Marquez showed up, where he likes to fall off.
So he's starting to explore the limits, but I do think that qualifying crash was just a slight glitch. Well, it was a mistake on his part, but an understandable one, given that, you know, he hasn't got much experience on the Ducati, and it just caught him out.
Because when did Gigi walk into Marquez's pit and talk to him? Was that after qualifying, or was that after the sprint? I can't remember.
I can't remember.
I think it was qualifying. I don't know. I just know DG walked in there. I wish I would have noted it more succinctly. But they had a long conversation with each other, and DG had the goatee stroke going. And
yeah, and he's been...
intently as to what happened.
Fulsome in his praise of Marquez, hasn't he?
Yeah.
On some of his social media posts as well. I don't know if he has somebody doing it for him, because obviously he's Italian, but his English is absolutely outstanding. And if you read any of the stuff that comes out on LinkedIn and the various social media channels... Yeah, very, very eloquent guy. And it's clearly a big Marquez fan, because the chatter has already started about whether Marquez actually goes up and partners Bagnaia next year in red.
Tasty thoughts there, isn't it?
That is going to be a discussion point. Well, although what happened on Sunday might have put a slight dent into that, but we'll come to that in a little while. Yes.
Details, Rich, details.
Yeah.
Oh, so where were we? Oh, we were into QT discussing Marquez's crash. Well, one thing we didn't talk about, Acosta in that first session, that the front end just going down 14, just absolutely just hammering that front end on that bike. In fact, Acosta loses the front and grabs it so much quicker than what Marquez ever did in the time that he was on his Honda. Like, Marquez would have had the front fold, would have been on the bow, picked it up and gone on, leaving a big blackie from the front. Acosta felt that way before Marquez would ever felt that. And then, you know, it just seems like, and it just didn't faze him. He went right back out there and just wobbled the bike around even more. It did it harder. It was stunning to watch Acosta come through the Q2 to Q1.
It was stunning to watch him all weekend, Jim, to be honest.
We're going to get there.
I mean, I'm conscious that we mustn't irritate the listeners too much, because you and I, obviously, as I think probably the vast majority of people are kind of looking at all this transpiring, thinking it almost doesn't seem quite real. But before I forget to mention it, because we were talking pre-show, the blip is his Moto2 2 years, where he would almost look not ordinary, because he won the championship, but conventional. On a MotoGP bike, he's looking like he did on a Moto3 bike, isn't he? And you can talk about it more in terms of what he's doing with the front end, but boy, God, does he put some force through the front of that bike, and
yes, he does
pivot the rear end around even more so than, say, Brad does on the KTM, and that's saying something.
If anybody's sideways, it's him, and it seems like Acosta's even more sideways. But let's get back to the qualifying, and we'll discuss those points when we get to them.
Yeah.
Just don't let me forget to talk about that. Okay. Where are we at? Martin had got a lap canceled because of track limits. It's the only conversation about track limits that happened all weekend long, and it very was blatantly done.
Yeah.
So that was correct call, take that lap away, which they did. Martin went to pole. He was then bested by Bastianini. Bagnaia's then bested Martin to be third. Bagnaia would be fourth on the grid, followed by Miller, Bezzecchi. Acosta would qualify seventh. Marquez would be eighth. Then Quartararo, Binder, and Rins in that qualifying session. So that's where we are. So we go to the sprint on Saturday. At the sprint, Mir almost crashes on the starting lap. Did you happen to catch that?
Oh, I didn't see that. No.
Oh, yes. Mir about threw it away on the starting lap. It was crazy because he had basically grabbed the front brake or whatever. It just didn't work. And it was really odd that that was there. When we saw Pedro Acosta on the grid, his eyes were closed. It was full concentration, full visualization. He seems as though he can sort of black out the distractions and really come and find that center that he needs to be in. Then we saw as they came to the line, Bastianini was having trouble with the pole shot device. He was pushing up and down on the bike, trying to collapse the forks, trying to make it work. He really couldn't get it to work. I'm like, ooh, okay, this is going to be interesting here. What are we going to do? He did get the back end drop down, but the front end was definitely not locked, or for some reason he couldn't activate it or got it out of sequence. Again, there's a very specific process it takes to put these bikes into a launch condition. There's a mode probably for the ECU, there's a mode for the rear, there's a mode for the front. It's got to be the front first, then the rear, and then they sit down. It was definitely interesting to watch what amounted, I will call it, minor panic by Bastianini as to what was going to go on. And you could see in the body language he was like, I'm just not going to get a start here. Because he knew what was going to happen, because everybody else has got theirs right, but he's going to do his best. It did wheelie a little bit off the line, I will admit, but he wasn't as bad as I thought it would be, but it still was not the best start compared to what everybody else did. Miller would lead into the first turn G, that KTM off the line, right? We know how good it is.
As always,
then,
yeah.
Yes, then Bagnaia, then Vinales, then Bastianini, then Marc Marquez, and then Martin. Pedro would fall back to 11th at the start of that. Marquez put on a hell of a ride to go up to 4th and push Bastianini back to 5th. Marquez would go up to 3rd because he would just stuff on that motorcycle wherever he could put it. There was that aggressive Marquez that you hadn't seen so in years, in 2 or 3 years, because he was riding on the front. He was trying to put the bike in places he shouldn't have put it. And getting away with it. So he kind of saw that old Marquez come back. Rins went down at 3, at turn 3. Zarco was down at turn 5. The rear stepped out on Binder, and he went down 2. Acosta got to 7th. Marquez was all out of shape in turn 5. He was all over it. The bike was just twitching back, forth, whichever way. It was amazing to watch that day, because turn 5 is the downhill, bottoms out there, and to go back up. Martin got by Marquez, which was a great move. Kind of did what Marquez does to everybody else. Bagnaia is out front, going away, followed by Vinales, Martin, Marc Marquez, Miller, Bagnaia, and Acosta. And then Bagnaia goes wide into turn 1, a rare mistake by the world champion. I don't know if it was, they say the wind was coming from behind, so they had a bit of a tailwind. I don't know if he misjudged that a little bit. I don't know if he just got the braking wrong. If you brake wrong and you're going down that crest, the back end is going to come up more than you expected. It could have moved around on him. He had to set it down, had to let off the brakes. He runs wide and he falls back to 4th. It was all kinds of sideways there. And he just was swapping sides. It was, again, a rare mistake by Bagnaia. Bagnaia has this sprint race won, but he doesn't. Well, that then leaves Vinales out front, followed by Martin, followed by Marc Marquez. And we finish off with Vinales getting by Martin to win the race, followed by Marc Marquez and Martin falling back to 3rd, because there was some great riding by both Vinales and Marc Marquez to get by in the last couple of laps. Bagnaia would struggle home to 4th, then Miller, then Bastianini. Acosta would go 7th, then it was Aleix, then Quartararo, and round of top 10 was Raul Fernandez. The sprint was intriguing. We saw a mistake from Bagnaia. We saw Martin, who is the sprint god, seem to be normal in that race. Marquez is on a podium with a Ducati. Granted, it's just a sprint, but we're seeing flashes of the Marc Marquez brilliance that's in the background. And then there's Vinales, sorry, Gary, with the win. It was like, okay, everything got switched on. I think it's just a really weird sprint race, right? And no matter how you slice it.
Where do we start with Vinales? I mean,
again, he was sick before the weekend started.
I mean, it was not the weekend really that you would have expected him to have done well. I mean, crucially, he got the bike off the line. I mean, that's always really, he's always quick. Sometimes he doesn't really qualify as well as he should given his practice pace. But his big weakness in recent times, well, pretty much all through, ever since he left Suzuki, anyway, as far as I can recall, is that, yeah, he just always seems to have problems getting off the line. Now, whether that's a him thing or a bike thing, you know, again, we don't know. He's always sort of insinuating that, certainly with regards to the Aprilia, that there are improvements required to the start procedure, the clutch, et cetera, et cetera. So, well, okay, sorry, Gary, but, you know, we're going to sing his praises a little bit here. You know, he is a phenomenally fast rider, and as much as he irritates the hell out of me, I've always liked Vinales. I've still got one of his T-shirts up in the drawer. So, which was from his Suzuki days, to be fair, but I was always a big Suzuki fan. But I just thought it was great to see him up the front and to win a sprint. I know it's not technically classed as a full Grand Prix win, but I don't really care about that, Jim. I don't know if you've kind of got any views on this, but as far as I'm concerned, in some respects, winning a sprint is an achievement, you know, that's very, very different and difficult because it is a much more intense race. And it was pretty frantic at the beginning of that race, it has to be said. Mm-hmm. So I thought Vinales was outstanding, to be honest with you. And okay, Bagnaia, slightly take issue with you that, you know, but in terms of not making mistakes very often, because he is prone to making mistakes and sort of throwing race-winning opportunities away.
Well, I was only thinking, I can only really think of like two. I mean, he did Coda last year. And then I guess he gets a mulligan every year somewhere. I mean, everybody kind of gets a mulligan.
Yeah.
But he does fall off, I guess, a little bit more than what I really
earlier in read his for. Works Ducati career, that first year, which was, what would that have been, 2020 or 21? He did make a lot of unforced errors, but he's a much different, much more accomplished rider, and he's a world champion. So, okay, fair enough. Whether it was wind that caught him out or just a little mistake, as you say, it wouldn't take much because it's so fast going down that hill into turn one.
Yeah.
I mean, you've only got to be a millisecond late or do something different, and that's what's going to happen. So, but yeah, just really pleased to see Vinales get a win. Good for him. Good for Aprilia, apart from anything else, which I think is also important. I mean, I tweeted out, you know, in all the elation towards Vinales, which was totally well deserved. I think, you know, the whole team, oh, what's his name? It's escaping me now. But the team manager, he deserves a lot of credit because he's really gelled that team together and, you know, brought Vinales in, which people were surprised about at the time, given the nature of his departure from Yamaha a couple of seasons ago. But it's starting to gel. So, yeah, I was personally thought that was a great podium with Marc Marquez in second. I mean, that's a standout ride from him as well. So, yeah, lots to point towards some really great racing this year.
Dude, I think we're in for some really good racing, to be honest with you. It's all shook up. You know, it's the fox among the chickens, right?
Because
You've got Marquez who just isn't going to care. And with Acosta, good grief.
Yeah.
You're like, whoa, boys and girls. So with that, let's go to the main event, right? The 25 laps that we do on Sunday. Martin got a whole shot. Marquez was charging up from his eighth place grid spot. Morbidelli ran off and then or was out, but then rejoined later on from a crash. What is the sad state of Morbidelli? He's on a Pramac Ducati, and he still looks as bad as he was when he was on the Yamaha. We know now Aldeger, has his seat. Rich, what's going on there? World Superbike bound? That's what I think.
I mean, unless he gets some sort of a... Let's not forget, in all likelihood, both seats at Pramac are up next year. So we know Aldeger's on one.
Yes.
I find it a little hard to believe that Martin will stay there, even though the team are obviously saying they want him to. Of course they're saying that. But he's going to want a works bike somewhere else.
He does have a works bike.
Well, what I mean is he wants to ride for the works team.
Okay.
So, yes, Fair. Technically, he's on a 24 bike, so he's not at any material disadvantage. But he doesn't have the kudos, and I think we know that he felt pretty hard done by Bastianini getting the ride previously. So Morbidelli, though, unless he gets rescued by VR46, but that could end up with him back on a Yamaha as well, which probably wouldn't be something that anybody would necessarily want. So, yeah, I think probably his time is starting to look shaky. I mean, he had a colossal crash at Portimao pre-season, which ruled him out of all of the pre-season testing, let's not forget. So he is
he's on the back foot
on the back foot at the moment and struggling with injury again. But that's been the case for, what, the last 3 years now? I forget where he really injured himself badly. I think it was a crash at Le Mans
a few years ago where he did his knee in,
and he's never been the same rider since.
Yeah.
So I think it's like starting to look a bit shaky for poor old Frankie Morbidelli, yeah.
Yep. So Alex Marquez would fall at turn five. He tucked the front. Raul Fernandez crashed. Miller went wide at turn one, and both Binder and Acosta leapt by to get ahead of him. Martin is out front. He's kind of pulling away. Vinales is right there, keeping pace with him. Bastianini, Bagnaia are battling with Marquez there, Binder, and then Acosta. Now, this next portion of the race, the front four guys are where they are, and there's not really a lot that's going to change. The action is all around a kid named Acosta, because Acosta gets by Binder and on a hard move, hard but fair, right? And he gets by. Then Acosta immediately just dropped Binder like he had thrown the anchor out and put it into reverse. And he raced up within two laps, was right with Bagnaia, the world champ. Now, the kid doesn't even care at this point, because that's just another motorcycle. And he just puts a pass on Bagnaia going into one that is probably one of the, if it doesn't become the pass of the year, it is a strong candidate for it, because he comes in hot. He leaves the braking way later than he probably should have. He clears Bagnaia and he knows he's got a problem because he can't get to the apex. So he throws the bike in dirt track style. I mean, you could easily have been looking head on and been able to read gas on the side of the bike, because he's that sideways with it. Now, as Richard said earlier, he's riding like he rides his Moto 3 bike. He wants a different apex that's earlier and tighter. So he's got it slowed down, and he's ready for it. He turns the gas back on. But as we said, Rich, he was riding only the second race, well, I guess, one, two, three, fourth race on that bike in the MotoGP class. I think he was running on talent alone. He makes the decision to ride sort of like his Moto3 bike. He throws the gas on, but that's not right the thing to do, because this bike has power and grip, which now picks the front back up, pushes him off his line of his apex, and Acosta just simply cracks the throttle, turns it on, and makes it go sideways again and finishes off that corner. All of this is within a blink of an eye. I had to back it up like three or four times. One of the things I think about this that's so amazing about Acosta is he's riding it like it's a Moto3 bike. He has lines that are so different than anybody else, carries the corner speed, amazing trust in the front end. There is something about the fact that there's a KTM DNA lineage here that MotoGP bike has inherently some, I know it doesn't really have genetic makeup, but it has some makeup in it that is exactly like what Acosta had before, and he's flourishing on it because it's natural to him. You know, the best description I can give it to you is I'm a big Honda fan. I love their cars. I love their Civics. So I've had SIs, a CRX. I wanted a Type R. I bought a Type R and I was worried because they won't let you test drive one. I'm like, am I making the right decision? Well, I get in the car. I start it up. It makes that same sound that every Civic makes when you start it. It makes the same sound in the gearbox when you go into reverse backwards. And it has the same little notchiness for second gear that all of them seem to have. There's something about the DNA of that car that I understand and I love. Acosta has that same relationship with this motorcycle, and you are going to see some wizardry from this kid with that. On the flip side to all this is the KTM isn't that bad of a motorcycle, and it makes you wonder what Jack and Brad are doing, because unfortunately Acosta is shading them right now.
I mean, they always say, Jim, the best riders, the best drivers, depending on what your poison is, outperform the machinery that they've got. And you know, every so often, I mean, I know we've said it and we're going to sound like broken records, and we're going to do this a lot this year, I'm afraid. Every so often, a talent comes along and it just outperforms. Well, it does two things. It outperforms the machinery, potentially, if the rider driver doesn't have the best machinery. And yeah, just the pure talent just shines through. I mean, I said to you before we started recording, Jim, with regards to Acosta, we were furiously swapping WhatsApp messages during the race on Sunday.
We were.
You yeah, don't know what you don't know. And so Acosta doesn't know what a pre-aero bike is like. He's only familiar with this 2024 machine. So he's just riding it as he feels is the best way. And, you know, the best way is clearly very, very, very fast. So, I mean, it must be scary for everybody else out there at the moment because he's putting some hard, clean, but hard moves on the very, very best that are out there at the moment. And it's going to be, as I sort of only half jokingly wrote to you on Jim, it's going to be hastening the early retirement of one or two riders or moving easily to World Superbike or something like that out there because, yeah, these people come along every so often. I suppose this was the second part of what I was trying to get at earlier on. I lost my train of thought. That they kind of shift the goalposts. This is kind of like what we saw with Marc Marquez when he showed up on the Honda, an extreme front-end style that he had. Acosta's kind of doing the same thing, but it's on a 2024 aero-dominated bike, so it's a bit different. And may I just sort of recount the John Watson thing that I said to you, because I think this is how one or two people...
It's very true.
I think this is how one or two people are going to feel. So back in 94, after Senna was killed in Imola, the BBC here in the UK ran a little documentary show on him. And they happened to interview John Watson, who was a very accomplished Formula One driver, multiple race winner in his time. And he was out on track testing at Brands Hatch. I guess this would have been about 83, 84, when Senna first turned up in the Tolman, or possibly would have gone across to the JPS Lotus at this point. Anyway, the point was that Senna overtook Watson in testing at Brands Hatch, and up through the Hawthorns, the back end of the track, up towards the old Dingle Dell corner, Watson said he just was in awe watching this car in front of him. And the words that came out of his mouth were, in those three corners, I knew my time in Formula One was effectively over. Because Senna was doing things with the car in terms of that. He had that sort of furious pumping of the throttle method, which in the turbo days, you had to keep it spooled up on the turbo boost. So he just was kind of like floating the car through on pure, you know, wheel spin and sliding. And you kind of see, I don't understand riding bikes well enough, even though I do ride a bike, but at an appallingly poor level. And you'll be much better placed to talk about this than I am, Jim. But even I can see that Acosta is riding the bike in a way that looks different to everybody else. A, you can see that his lines are different. He was much tighter, which means he's earlier on the gas, coming out of some of the turns in Portimao. And going into the turns, well, that's a whole other story. I mean, you could spend hours talking about that because the bike is like way out of shape sideways. As I think I alluded to, early period 990cc MotoGP when the electronics weren't there and they were kind of backing it in because the slipper clutches were so kind of underdeveloped at that stage. He's putting so much trust and speed in the front end, and he's pivoting the bike by throwing the rear end out as well. And he's doing all of that whilst overtaking people and cutting a tighter line. So he's definitely moving the goalposts, and a few people are going to be scratching their heads. Chief amongst them is teammate Augusto Fernandez. And Jack Miller, I would think, as well. I mean, Binder, I think, had a bit of an off race because I think he was trying some stuff on the bike and it didn't quite work out. And he'd had a bit of a rough weekend anyway because he crashed on the Saturday. So, you know, Binder's a stellar talent as well. But there's absolutely no doubt that Acosta and him are going to be teammates. And the question at the moment is that going to happen within this season?
No, I don't think it happens in this season.
I hope it doesn't, because I think it's better that Acosta's in gas, and just purely for Hervé Poncharal, I want to see him smiling his way through a whole season with this kid and his team, because he deserves it.
Mm-hmm. You're so right about how Acosta rides. It's so different than anybody else. And it is, I think he has, I don't know how to say it, by skill, by luck, or whatever, he's figured out that because you have to have these harder tires that you have to work with the air pressure and stuff, with the aero, that the only way to ride is to ride it harder. The harder you ride it, the better it sticks. And if it sticks, now I can pivot the back. And he's just changed it fundamentally, because everybody else, if you look at everybody else on the grid who's there, there's some exceptions. There's a few that aren't there. Augusto Fernandez pops out. That most everybody rode MotoGP bikes before they became aero-dependent, super aero-dependent, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, some of them, you know, there's the little wings in the front that we're playing around with. But now these things are ride height devices, and they move and they change shapes and all this other stuff. And Acosta just changes shapes with it. He just doesn't care, because he said he doesn't know. I think of it this way. Acosta is this rare breed. He has everything you would ever want. He has the racer part of it down pat, right? He also has this ability to manage races and learn while he's doing it at a high level. You know, so all the greats have used 90% of their brain to race, but 10% of it is thinking about what else is happening around you and where everybody else is and where are they weak and where are my competitors weak and where am I strong? Where can I take an advantage? He is an absolute dream of a person to have as an interview for the things that he says. I mean, the comment of Matt Oxley, well, you put your balls on and go. That's just gold in a way that no one else is going to do it. And yet he still has that assassin style of going after people and not caring that that's Mark Marquez or that that's Pecco Bagnaia or that is who Brad Binder. It doesn't matter. He's still going to go after you. He has all of this. And the thing of it now is that you look at it, it's all raw. And we're going to watch this mold and change in shape as he really figures this out and then becomes a true bona fide superstar. Like we're talking, if KTM can continue the bike development and give him incrementally something better, he's going to become dominant at world championships to the point that this may be the person who actually beats Rossi's nine, right?
Well, he's certainly that kind of epoch changing.
He's that kind of epoch. So, I mean, it's phenomenal. I cannot begin to try to explain to everyone where Acosta is on the thinking scale, which is the part that's there. If you wanted to have the DNA of the ultimate racer, you would have the brain of Wayne Rainey. You would have the skill and natural ability of like a Freddie Spencer with the Assassin's Creed of Mark Marquez. If you had all that mixed together, that's Pedro Acosta. And he still has respect for the other things in this world that don't really, he's humble. He understands his place. You know, I mean, his father was a fisherman, I think, right? That's Acosta's dad. Yeah, that's right. But his hero is Michael Dunlap, you know, from the roads.
Yeah.
He's just absolutely positively brilliant in what he does and how he does it. And that can't be coached. That's just him being the person that he is.
Yeah, there's a little bit of the kind of the Rossi free spirit about him at the moment. And let's hope that that doesn't get...
He can't lose that.
...driven out of him through success and through, you know, he'll have to become a bit more corporate, although they already are, you know, very well trained when it comes to this sort of thing by this stage. But you hope that that essential kind of magic, that love that you can clearly see that he has, that, you know, that real sort of pizzazz for everything and around what he's doing, you hope that that doesn't get kind of driven out of him as the cynicism grows, because that's, you know, there's a degree of inevitability about that as people's careers wind on. But he's right at the very, very beginning. And to be doing this in the second round is just jaw-dropping, really.
And he has until Sachsenring to be the youngest rider to win a MotoGP race. Plenty of opportunities.
And I think in the last show, Jim, we were saying, you know, we were sort of surmising that we could foresee a podium come in. Well, there it is. You know, a win. I mean, the other thing that we shared is that if there's a slight weakness, and I emphasize the word slight in very small font, it would be, you know, the single lap pace to get himself on the first one or two rows. When he gets that bit figured out, and that could be within the next 1 to 2 rounds, you know, he will definitely be a contender for race wins then. Because at the moment, he's having to come through from what, row 3 or 4 or 5? Yep. And that is a disadvantage, particularly in this era of bikes with all the aero. So, but it doesn't seem to be bothering him too much. So, I mean, lucky in a sense for him that they changed the tire pressure rule, but well, lucky for everybody and particularly for the spectators as well. So he doesn't have that worry of getting, you know, binned out of a race on a penalty at the end. But I mean, it's absolutely just mouth watering, isn't it? Every race coming up at the moment. Plus, you've got potentially a resurgent Aprilia in there as well. Mark Marquez coming on the Ducati as he figures it out. I mean, loads to look forward to. I mean, we haven't stopped talking about the race yet, but because we got sidetracked by, you know, the Wonder Kid. But
yeah,
there wasn't really an awful lot more to talk about, really, because Acosta was the big sort of show stealer.
Yeah, he is. He stole the show, but he stole it for other reasons too, because as he got past Bagnaia, Martin was trying to break away. Martin is there with Vinales and all that. And it really, you now have settled in. You've got Martin, Vinales, Bastianini. You got Acosta. They're just there hanging out. And you're wanting to see just where it's going to go. It settled in and you thought, okay, this is it. Acosta misses the podium. He's going to be fourth. You know, that's okay. But, you know, the racing gods smiled upon us with the final four-ish laps to the point where Marquez puts his head down to try to get to the podium. So he gets aggressive, and he gets aggressive on Bagnaia, to which then they go to turn five, and, well, Marquez puts the move on, but he runs in tight, which means he goes wide. He's going to V it off, if you will, square the corner, and dive back down. Well, who's there but Bagnaia? The two of them come together and touch. They fall off. It was deemed a racing incident. Rich, are you okay with that, or do you think somebody's at fault?
I'm totally okay with that. I thought it was a pure racing incident.
I'm 100% behind you. It was a racing incident.
I would say 50-50 in actual fact. I mean, a lot of people have been saying, oh, 70% Pecco, or, you know, vice versa, whatever. For me, complete 50-50.
I'm a 60-40 Pecco, only because of the fact that you saw Marquez go by. You were able to see what he was going to do. He was going to come back. I don't argue you trying to get to that point, but you kind of should have been prepared for at least the contact that you were going to have.
But I think that applies to Marc Marquez as well, because he might well have known, having gone a bit wide, that Bagnaia would probably come up the inside. They're both unsighted as well, because one's looking left and leaning off the bike. The other's kind of in a blind spot.
Yep.
So that's why I go 50-50. I mean, it's just one of those.
It's one of those things. Again, it's just that's going to happen, because this is what you're going to see, because this championship, by this happening and seeing what's developing here, this championship's wide open. There is... As much as I thought early in the year, man, wow, Bagnaia's fast on that Ducati. This 24 bike is insane. Oh, here comes the third championship in a row. Well, Acosta's going to be a cool side note. No, it's like all this is now front and center, including the Acosta portion of it, the Marquez resurgence that's happening. Oh, and by the way, we've got a rivalry back again, which, geez, like we just didn't, like, we have been smiled upon for this season, because this is how it's going to be all year long.
Jim.
All this,
I think the significance, or there is a little bit more significance to the Bagnaia Marquez crash, not so much the crash itself, because as we've just said, I think that was pretty much shared responsibility there. But, you know, that's two bulls in the same field, that one's in the works team, the other could end up in the works team. You know, there's a lot at stake there. And although he had his visor down, of course, you know, that look that Bagnaia shot across to Marquez as they were kind of trudging off. Marquez was busy picking his bike up, and I think he did remount and rejoin the race, whereas Bagnaia didn't. But you can just feel that this one's going to boil up and boil over a good few times. And I would not be surprised if the next occurrence is at COTA, actually, because Marquez is obviously going to be strong there. And Bagnaia's was good there last year. I know he crashed in the race, but yeah, there's going to be, I think that's going to be a season-long story, because there's quite a bit of politics behind the scenes there, and some big egos for that matter as well.
Yes, there are.
It's very, very spicy for us to watch.
So spicy. Anyway, we're still not done with all the craziness, because as we head to the final lap, of course, now this crash here, this still has Acosta off the podium at this point. But what happens now on the last lap is that you get Vinales on the last lap having a problem with the bike. He goes in, he basically, all of a sudden, he was always catching Martin, but on the straightaway, Martin would pull away. And this time it was like even worse, because Vinales had kind of gotten by Martin, I think, a little bit there. And Martin come back by him, and it was like, oh, there's like, wow, like what happened to the bike? And some people said, well, he was celebrating early, like Galeix did in Catalonia. I'm like, no, that body language is not that. To me, I thought we were WhatsApping back and forth. We thought the bike had run out of gas. I really thought that was a probability.
Yeah.
But it wasn't, because Vinales then carries on to turn one. He runs wide. He then falls, gets sort of high sided off the bike. Come to find out, it was a gearbox problem. The bike wouldn't go into sixth gear. Occasionally, he'd keep trying, and eventually it would, which meant he was down on speed, because he was in fifth running on the rev limiter instead of running on sixth. There, the gearbox packed up and was done. And so that then gives Acosta the podium that we wanted for him to have. Martin wins. Bastianini is second. Great. I love Bastianini being second. That was fabulous. Acosta's third. Then it's Binder, Miller, Bezzecchi, Quartararo, Aleix, Oliveira, and DJ Antonio in the top 10. Marquez would get a 16th. Credit for a 16th position. I do think he, because Zarco got the last point. So it is a wild and woolly, crazy season that we are going to see. And the best part was when they interview Acosta for it, he says, well, you know, we did pretty good today, but we really need to work on our one lap pace and qualifying. He knows that that's what he's got to fix. He knows he can race with them. He knows he has the bike to race with them. I can't imagine being Pit Beyer. I'd have to have a grinectomy because literally I would not stop smiling the whole time. I wouldn't be able to stop myself. And then, you know, and then Acosta thinks what is, I don't think it's personal, but Paoli is the head of the group of the KTM group. He thanks him. He turns, you know, thank you. Thank you to Pit. Thank you to the team. He understands that this is not him. It's about this bigger picture. He's everybody's dream. Yeah. It just really is. I know we ramble on about this. I know we really probably shouldn't, but guys, you have to understand you're watching something that I didn't think we'd see again this soon. When Marquez did what he did starting like in 2013, that was something incredible because there was a ledge and then there was an edge and there was a ledge beyond the edge. Oh, okay. Well, now Acosta is even farther along, probably quicker than what Marquez was, perhaps, right? And let us say that Acosta is more healthy than Marquez because we don't have to worry about Dilopia with a bang to the head. We don't have to worry about the arm or the shoulder. Now, he did break a femur. I'm not going to deny that, but he took the time off. He rehabbed properly, those kind of things. And yeah, okay, he's 19 years old. He's like rubber. I got that too. But I can't think of any 19-year-old that has the poise and the mental capacity that Acosta has. It is truly the old head on young shoulders.
Yeah. I mean, the only negative, and negative is the wrong word. The only sort of slight downside to all of this, and I don't mean this at all in an insulting way, so that nobody should take it this way, but it's a kind of a shame that he's Spanish. If he were a non-Spaniard, non-Italian, that would be so good for the championship because it would open up, you know, another major market somewhere else. Whereas Spain and Italy have been so successful at producing talent after talent after talent. So it's not a shame that he's Spanish, but it would be from the point of view of the sport. If he was, I don't know, South American or
American, you'd have another race in the US guaranteed. Somewhere there'd be another race in the US.
It would be even bigger box office from the championship's point of view. But I mean, irrespective of all of that, I mean, Acosta is going to be a global superstar. I don't think there's any doubt about that. The question for me is, does he kind of reach the Marquez level of fame and adulation, or does he go that next step, then get into the sort of the Michael Jordan, Valentino Rossi, Ayrton Senna kind of league where they transcend the sport?
My guess is he transcends it.
Yeah, I hope so, because I mean that would be obviously a great thing for MotoGP at a time where, well, in a period of time, let's say over the last few years, when the sport has, let's be honest, I think it's struggled a bit in terms of social media or social presence and audience figures, spectator figures. These have been problematical, particularly as Formula One bizarrely has done so well, driven in large part, I think, by Drive to Survive. Yeah, I agree, Jim. You know, the racing on track and the behavior and all the whinging and moaning, all, you know, the off-track drama and stuff is so pathetic and boring and just depressing, really, compared to, you know, the glory days that I consider of Formula One in the 80s and 90s. But anyway, putting that to one side, MotoGP has a massive opportunity now to really become a bit more global again in its reach. And if the powers that be, and, you know, we're hoping we might, either you or I at some point this year, might get to speak to Dan Rosamondo, who seems quite willing to have a chat with us, which will be interesting because we can ask a few of these questions about how does MotoGP now go this next step or several steps to increase its presence on the global stage in terms of people kind of watching this sport and thinking, bloody hell, this is good. You know, I know there are problems, and I was having a little interaction with one of the subscribers. I think it might have been Darren. I'm trying to remember now because I've been speaking to a few people, but he was kind of making the point that the direction the sport's gone in is just not his cup of tea and isn't really watching it very much. And that's a shame, but I understand why. You know, you look at one of these bikes and you think, well, what does that relate to? Because they're sort of spaceships now, aren't they, really? And my personal hope is that the 2027 regs bring them back to looking a bit like they used to, which is a bit retrograde, I suppose. But I'm not a big fan of all the aero, if I'm honest, and all the devices and stuff. I think we could well do with getting rid of some of those for various reasons. Safety would be one of them. So anyway, that's for the future. But certainly in terms of where we are right now, it's a massive opportunity for the sport with a talent like Acosta coming on the scene.
Yeah, it is. They cannot spoil this. They cannot miss this opportunity. You don't get these. They don't come around very often. So We'll take that. We have been going for quite some time with this one, but we'll look at the points from this. Now, Martin leads the championship on 60 points. He's going to have it for 3 weeks until we get to Austin. Bender is second in points. Bastianini third, then Benyaya. He falls. That non-point score drops Benyaya down the list to fourth. Acosta is fifth in points. And he's, you know, I get it. He's 32 down, but I got to believe that there's so many people are going to be taking points off of everybody else in this championship that it's going to be wild to see this championship unfold. It is not going to be a bore like I thought it was going to be. That I am 100% sure of.
Yeah, 100% agree. Yeah.
Yep. So that is everything from this weekend, which is great. Again, I will be in COTA. Anybody who wants to meet up, have a chat at COTA, please reach out to me on my Instagram or my Twitter or X, whatever you want to call it, at MotoRGV. It's even at MotoRGV on Threads as well. So if you guys want to have a chat, something like that, we certainly can while I'm in COTA, because I will be there for the weekend as well. And
although we've kind of run the clock out now, maybe we'll have an opportunity to do it briefly next time. But anyway, people really ought to try and seek out the World Superbike races from Catalunya at the weekend. The sprint race in particular on Sunday morning was just off the charts great. I mean, if you can find it on YouTube, it's probably there. Go and find it. Toprak Razgatlioglu winning two races on the BMW. I mean, people thought he had made a huge mistake going to BMW. The talk persists about BMW coming into MotoGP once the new rules are announced. I think it's going to happen. I don't necessarily think Toprak will come, because he might be getting, you know, perhaps a bit old for it by then, although he'd be worth a punt. But I've always said that within the World Superbike context, he is a next level talent there, in the same way that Marquez has been in MotoGP in recent years, and Acosta most definitely and clearly is. So yeah, he turned a 5-second deficit into a win on the Saturday first race, because Buniga burned his tyre and Toprak. I mean, the BMW has never worked at Catalunya. The rear grip has always been a problem, and yet he was on fire all weekend. Won the sprint race as well. Was on the podium, I think, in the final race. So if you can find the World Superbike races, they do really deserve and demand more close scrutiny in terms of our sort of race reviews, Jim, although I know you don't get to watch them. So again, if somebody out there in the listenership is, you know, a full-on World Superbike supporter and fancies doing maybe not every race weekend, but an occasional, you know, two or three times during the year, World Superbike catch-up, I'm happy to do that, because, you know, I watch World Superbike, much to my wife's annoyance, along with everything else, pretty religiously, and it's absolutely fantastic this year. You've got Iannone in there, paging in. You've got Sam Lowes, who's turned up, led the first race. Okay, he crashed, but doing really well on the Ducati. Just, you know, there's so much to talk about. It's so good, the racing. And they do look like proper motorbikes as well, most of them. So that's in its favour as well. So, yeah, let us know if anybody wants to come on and chat a little bit about World Superbike at some point this year. I'll catch up with Greg Haynes again in a few weeks. I've already organised that. So, yeah, I think that's everything from me, Jen. Yeah, great weekend of racing. I mean, yeah, just awesome.
Give me more of those and I'm happy.
Absolutely. Yeah, yeah. Kid in the candy shop.
So with that, Rich, I will tell everybody to ride safe.
Cheers, everyone.